Thank you to Red Eye, the Photography Network, for partnering with us to produce Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. Red Eye is a not-for-profit organization with a strong ethical focus, offering support and opportunities to help you advance your photography and your career. Find out more at redeye.org.uk. Welcome to Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. I'm your host, Savannah Dodd, and I'm the founder of the Photography Ethics Center. Each week, I'll be talking with an accomplished photographer about the ethics of their practice. Today, in episode number 5, we'll be talking with Michelle Pearson-Clark about vulnerability. Michelle Pearson-Clark is a Trinidad-born artist, writer, and educator who works in photography, film, video, and installation. Using performative and process-oriented strategies, her work situates grief as a site of possibility for social engagement and political connection. Based in Toronto, she holds an MSW from the University of Toronto, and in 2015, she received her MFA in Documentary Media Studies from Ryerson University. Michelle was the inaugural 2020-2021 Artist in Residence at the University of Toronto's Bonham Center for Sexual Diversity Studies. Currently, she is a part-time lecturer at both Ryerson University and the University of Toronto, and the second photo laureate for the City of Toronto from 2019 to 2022. Could we start with you just telling me a little bit about the kind of work that you do?
I'm a visual artist, so I make work that uses either photography or film or video to explore the themes that I'm interested in, which primarily I would say is grief and loss. I also teach, I write, I think about my relationship to photography as a kind of multifaceted thing. And even though as an artist, I make more moving image work than still image work, I think photographically, if that makes sense. So I would say that conceptually and theoretically, I'm very informed by the ways that we think about the work that images do in the world. And that is something that I explore in my work. And also, I'm currently wrapping up a 3-year term as the photo laureate for the City of Toronto. I think most folks might have heard of a poet laureate. Many cities and towns have a poet laureate, but we are one of only a handful of cities that also have the parallel position of a photo laureate. And basically, the role has been to be an advocate and an ambassador for photography and visual arts in the city.
I saw an interview that you had done talking about your role as a photo laureate, and I think that was one of the things that really drew me to wanting to speak to you. You said something about how, you know, we all look at photographs, we all take photographs, we all have a relationship to photography. And you talked about encouraging a social justice approach to photography, and I'd really love to hear more from you on that.
Yeah, I think it's probably my tagline that I've said so many times in talking about this role. But the poet laureate, you know, most people don't read poetry and most people don't write poetry. So the poet laureate is bringing poetry into their life where maybe it hasn't existed. Whereas my approach to my role is that everybody makes photographs and everybody looks at photographs. So everybody already has this relationship to photography. And with the invitation to become the photo laureate, the invitation really allows for you to make the role as you wish. And so for me, I really wanted to invite Torontonians to think about the work that photographs do. I guess my overall framework for my role has been building a sense of visual literacy, because I think those of us who work in our industry, no matter what part of it, that's something maybe we take a little bit for granted. And we've always been an image-dominated culture, but obviously that has increased, you know, a kajillion fold, you know, in the last decade or two. And like everything else, photographs are part of systems of power. Photographs get used to communicate certain things, to hide certain things. And so that social justice framework or that social justice approach in my time, in my past 3 years, has really just been trying to create opportunities for people who may not have thought about photography in that way before, because, you know, ethics, all of the issues that we will be talking about today and that everybody talks about on this podcast, they no longer just apply to professional photographers, right? We're all publishers, we're all broadcasters, we're all making and disseminating photographs now. And so it just felt like an appropriate thing to do in my time.
You know, when I first founded the Photography Ethics Center, I think one of the things that I found was that everybody I talked to had a story about photography and ethics. Everybody had a situation that happened to them that was unethical, that they did and they weren't sure if it was ethical, that they've witnessed or they've heard of, or everybody had a story to tell me. I mean, to this day, I tell people what I do and everybody wants to tell me, you know, a story. And I think that that's really interesting. And I think it points to something that's really embedded in our culture. But at the same time, I wonder, do you think that people are aware that they have a relationship to photographs? Because I think you're completely right. We all do. You know, it's not just professionals. All of us have a relationship. But I wonder if people think of it in that way.
I would say no. You know, I think the way that the camera phone has slipped into all of our pockets, it just happens so organically, you know, over time. And the building up of social media platforms over that time as well, you know, it's really shifted the ways that we make photographs, the functions of them. You know, before social media, nobody would take a photograph of their breakfast and instantly publish it. You know what I mean? So it's changed the types of photographs that we take. Photography on those platforms, it's a language, right? It's a form of communication. And it blurs between spoken language, written language, and now image language. So I'm not sure that people think about it in those types of ways. But I'm not surprised to hear that everybody has a story for you, because I think it speaks to the ways that power is embedded in photography. Because all of these ethical dilemmas, all of these ethical questions, they have a very strong relationship to power and to impact. And that is just embedded when you are behind the camera, you hold a certain type of power. And to me, that comes with enormous responsibilities. And even with social media, you know, everybody now has the ability to share their thoughts and to share their opinions, but there's still a different kind of cultural weight placed on something that is posted on Instagram versus something that's published, you know, on the front page of a newspaper, or something that is published in a book, or something that is, you know, mounted on the wall in a prestigious gallery. So to me, it's an enormous privilege to have access to those platforms to share my thoughts and my opinions and to say, this is something I think you should look at. This is something I think you should see. This is something that I think is worthy of cultural consideration. So to me, with that privilege, there's even more responsibility to really address those questions as best you can.
How do you think about impact, I guess, in your work?
I have this conversation with my students all the time. I teach part-time at both Ryerson University and University of Toronto. And I think, you know, a lot of what we do is ego work as artists. I can only speak, you know, I don't work commercially. I work, as I said, as a visual artist. But I think it's really okay to think that, you know, maybe your photograph is only going to do not that much in the world, you know, particularly when it comes to ethics. I think often there's a overinflation of what we think our photographs will do or can do, and that often gets held up as justification for showing an image that people question, why are you showing this image, you know? And it's like, well, it has to be seen, you know, it has to be shown. And not everything has to be seen, not everything has to be shown. And even if we show something, will it actually really lead to change? Will it actually move the needle in any significant way? There's maybe a handful of photographs in the entire history of photography that have really led to dramatic social change. So it's okay to think about just reaching one person, you know? It's okay to think that maybe only a really small, tiny group of people will see your image and feel something they hadn't felt before, or come to know something they hadn't known before. So for me, you know, most of my work is really thinking about what does it mean to hold space for grief and loss in the gallery space? And primarily, what does it mean to ask people to think about the griefs and losses that Black people feel and the griefs and losses that queer people feel? And as somebody who is both of those things, you know, often there's that intersection in my work as well. Because we know that the history of photography has shown a certain type of pain, you know, associated with my communities, pain often due to extreme violence, pain due to extreme trauma. And my work is more concerned with the kind of everyday, you know, more mundane pains. Some that definitely have to do with the impact of oppression, because, you know, to be Black is to feel grief every day. To be queer is to feel grief every day over the ways that you are just denied, you know, full access to your humanity. So I think that for me, my priority in terms of impact when it comes down to it is for my communities to come into, particularly, you know, the history of the gallery space as a colonial space, as a space that's not often very welcoming, also as a space that is biased to a kind of quiet, sparse, restrained way of being. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago. I mean, I come from a loud place. I come from a place where everybody is like vying for, you know, entertaining each other. People dress colorfully, you know. And so my impact is for my communities to come into the gallery and feel seen, feel understood, feel a sense of community and togetherness.
And in terms of focusing on themes of grief and pain, what do the ethics of that look like? Because it is quite difficult, I guess, when you're working with people and you're asking them to revisit that with you or to show you something of that. And I can imagine that can be a very delicate process.
It's an ongoing ethical dilemma. There's no question. You know, I don't think that I can ever free myself. I don't think ethics is a black and white thing where you can say, you know, here's a checklist, and if you do all of these things, like, you are ethically clear, you know? It's just, as I said, it's just so embedded into the process of making a photograph of somebody else. And so my ethical dilemma that is embedded in my practice is, what does it mean for me to ask community members to be vulnerable for my camera? And what does it mean, especially given the history of making Black people's pain a spectacle for consumption? What does it mean to not just ask people to be vulnerable, but what does it mean to show that in a gallery? What does it mean to present and display Black and queer vulnerability and pain in the gallery space? And so for me, it really comes down to, you know, the whole reason I make work about grief and loss is really comes from my own experience. You know, when my mother passed away a decade ago, I had a very, very traumatic grief response. I felt so ill-prepared for what grief actually is like. You know, she was ill for a long time. And if you had asked me before she died what it will be like, I would just say, oh, I'll feel sad, because that's what our culture had told me. You know, grief is sadness. I didn't understand that grief is rage, grief is anxiety, grief is, you know, it's a very complex, ongoing life experience. And it's also the most universal life experience. But our culture, particularly Western culture, is very, very sort of taboo and hidden in lots of ways. And so art was one of the things that helped me and really drove me to kind of go back to school and do my MFA and sort of pursue the career that I have now, in terms of trying to make more public space for grief and loss, bringing it out from, you know, this private, domestic, hidden thing that we get told we have to do, and for it to be okay for something to consider in the gallery space. So the ethical dilemma of what does it mean to pursue vulnerability, to display pain, is in service of something that I think is important enough that I strive to do it. And all any of us can do is kind of build into the ways that we work ethical practices. And I try to do that as much as possible. Before I was an artist, I have a master's in social work. I have an undergraduate degree in psychology, and I worked as a health educator for a long time before switching careers. And many of the ways of working with people in my previous career, I brought those with me. You know, it's different boundaries. I'm an artist now. I'm not a therapist, and I am very mindful of that. But definitely all of the skills that I developed in my first career inform the way that I work. So I'll give one example. Is informed consent is an important principle in my practice. And so for every project, I build a website. I build a project website that allows me a lot of space to be able to say who I am, why I'm making what I'm making, where it will show, you know, like I just put all the information that I can about what I'm doing and what the outcome is going to be. So people can read that on their own time before deciding, yes, I would like to participate in this. So there's just, for me, the relationship between not just me and the person that I'm photographing, but me and my broader community, you know, the responsibilities that I feel that I have to myself, to my participants, and to my broader community, and to the audience as well, right? What am I asking of the audience when I'm making images? All of those things factor into, you know, the ethical framework that guides my decisions and the ways that I work.
I love so much of what you've just said. I mean, I think that your idea of having a project website is such a brilliant way to deal with informed consent. I've not come across other people talking about that practice. So I think that's really interesting. And I also really identify with what you said about, you know, using your background in social work and how that informs your practice as a photographer. My background is in anthropology, and that also has really informed my practice as a photographer. Also, a lot of ways about consent, you know, and about impact and power and, you know, all those things that I sort of gained from that background. I think that there's so many, yeah, useful interdisciplinary learnings that we can take from each other who have these different backgrounds in different areas. That's really, really interesting. I'd like to know a little bit more. You know, you said that, you know, an ethical dilemma for you is portraying the suffering of Black and queer people in a gallery setting where that has a lot of times been from a colonial lens or a objectifying, gazy sort of lens. How do you overcome that? Or how do you contextualize the work so that it works against that when you're exhibiting work?
You know, it's something that definitely has evolved over, you know, I've been a full-time artist since 2015. And even, you know, the works that I've just completed are different than the works I made even 5 years ago. And I don't think you can really, nothing can really prepare you for that. That has come from making the work, but being in the gallery with it, living with it, seeing how people interact with it. And I think for me, it comes down to sort of some formal choices. My work, I'm really, performance theory has been really helpful for me in terms of thinking about, particularly with representations of Black people. You know, we know that photography is complicit in the construction of race as we think of it now. We know that photography has taught us to see Blackness in certain types of derogatory and negative and damaging ways. And so for me as a contemporary artist, I think about any new image that I make, we've all been exposed to 150, 175 years of these images, and they operate almost like a thick filter that you have to be able to see through. And I don't know that I can free myself of that filter, right? I know that that filter is going to shape how people see. And I see it often in the ways that critics will write about my work. You know, no matter what I say about the work, you know, Blackness and representation are foregrounded in people's response to the work because that's what they've been taught to see and that's what they've been taught to respond to. So I use performance, I use repetition. I'm very interested in trying to foreground an affective response. I'm very much influenced by and think alongside Tina Camp's theorizing of listening to images and the ways that images produce frequencies and how depending on what we feel is going to affect what we see. And so those are the types of formal strategies that I use. I mean, I do think of my work as documentary, but I don't use traditional photojournalistic or documentary practices. I'm always working with, you know, quote unquote, real people, but it really comes down to playing with some formal strategies that hopefully nudge people into a relationship. I'm really interested in that relationship between feeling and seeing and sort of the ways those feedback on each other.
And I guess as well, I was looking at your website beforehand, obviously, and something that I really noticed in a lot of your work is that as much as you're asking the people that you're working with to be vulnerable with you, you're also quite vulnerable in a lot of your own work. And I guess is that, I mean, I'm sure that's a conscious decision, but I guess does that sort of play into the ethics of your practice?
That's become more of an explicit shift, particularly with, I can speak a little bit about my newest works. But it has come, as I said, from that reflection over this short period of time. And I've said this before too, but I really came to understand that I am not a good judge of what other people will be willing to do, because for whatever reason, I am very comfortable with vulnerability. So I've had several projects either completely fall apart, or I would really have to shift what I was doing, because what I was asking the community to do, people were like, sounds great, but hell no. And I was like, oh, but I would do it. Like, how, you know? So I was like, oh, what you're willing to do, most people are not willing to do. So I really started to think about how do I introduce more opacity and refusal into my work to continue to ask people to be vulnerable, but not in the ways that are comfortable just for me, you know? How do I abstract people in other forms? But part of that self-reflection too was me thinking about, okay, what would it mean for you to, and I've been in my own work before, but really thinking about what would it mean for me to walk my own talk? You know, what would be the thing that if another artist asked me, I would be like, hell no. And it took, you know, I don't know, 0.03 of a second to be like singing, because I have had lifelong terrible shame over my inability to sing. So the seed that got planted maybe 2-3 years ago around that has just opened at the Art Gallery of Hamilton in a new 4-channel video installation called Quantum Choir, where I wanted to use that vulnerability around singing publicly and shame about singing to reflect on the vulnerability of queer female masculinity. So I reached out to community and I found 3 other women who are, you know, queer and masculine and also feel shame around their inability to sing. We worked with a vocal coach for 2 months. We learned to sing Queen of Denmark by John Grant. And so in this 4-channel video installation, the first half of it is us doing our vocal warm-ups. So I just use repetition and performance, and it's just, you know, we're just making these sounds and building just this choreography and symphony of those vocal warm-ups. And then, you know, we stretch and then we sing this song. And, you know, I worked on that for 6 months. It's been open for 2 weeks. And I think about it and I get a little tense, you know. But I already can see, you know, we have this paradoxical relationship to vulnerability in our culture, where when you're vulnerable, very often people will say, you're so brave. This is so amazing. I couldn't do it. And even though people will admire vulnerability in others, it doesn't make it necessarily easier to be vulnerable. So it doesn't sort of translate into feeling like, oh, if I'm vulnerable, maybe people will admire me. Because we know that people still do get punished, right? That your vulnerability can be turned against you. It can be weaponized against you. And so, yes, it continues to be very difficult to be vulnerable. But, you know, Laverne Cox has introduced that term of being a possibility model. And I think that's one of the powerful things about being vulnerable, is it offers a possibility to other people, right? It's sort of like, oh, this person, what's the thing I need to be vulnerable about? Like we sort of can empower each other to be vulnerable when we go there. And I've experienced that, you know, in terms of people's responses to the work already. And, it, you know, Quantum Choir is not necessarily an invitation to overcome bad singing, if that's a shame that you feel, but it's an invitation to think about what does it mean to lean into a hard thing, and what's maybe a hard thing that you want to lean into for your own life. No, it's not a project I did by myself. It also intentionally involved 3 other people, because we know that it's easier to do a hard thing when you're holding hands with somebody else, you know?
And how has that experience, or has that experience made you think differently at all about your photography practice, or has it informed your photography practice, or maybe things that you're thinking about now?
Well, it definitely, all of my work to date, I would say, you know, is autoethnographic. So my work always is rooted in my own experiences. And most often, I know that anything I'm experiencing in the world, I'm not unique. Other people feel the things that I feel. So most of my work to date has involved finding other people who share my feelings around a certain identity or my feelings around a certain experience. And together we tell the story of that feeling, that emotion, that experience. And with Quantum Choir, there's a shift where I've put myself into it as well. And I'm alongside my community doing that. In the exhibition where Quantum Choir is on view right now, it is showing alongside a selection of photographs that's from an ongoing self-portrait series. So together, both works really are foregrounding me stepping in front of the camera. And so the self-portrait series is about the intersection of my aging, my masculinity, my blackness, and my queerness, because I've always been read as younger than I am. But, you know, more recently, as my physical body is beginning to show, you know, signs of aging, I find that I'm experiencing more hostility from people. And I don't know for sure, but I've sort of been reflecting on what does it mean to be moving from being read as a young black boy to being read as a black middle-aged man. And for some people, you know, a black man is a very threatening thing. And so my body is becoming more threatening to certain people as I age. And as I was thinking about that, I was really struck by really how absurd that is, and how absurd it is that, you know, alongside with everything else that we all have to deal with as we age. My knees hurt, my hangovers last a week, you know, and I have to worry about more risk and less safety for myself in the world. And so this self-portrait series is me sort of in intentionally absurd scenarios as I grapple with this response to my masculinity and my blackness. But the absurdity is also a way for me to sort of take pleasure back for myself, because I'm enjoying aging and I don't want my aging experience to be defined by the gaze of other people. So together, both of these works have me thinking about what does it mean for me to be in front of the camera. And I do see that continuing in certain ways, but I also now find myself really drawn to thinking about moving even further into opacity and abstraction, and what does it mean to explore the vulnerability of Black and queer people if Black and queer people are not actually visible in the image.
You've said at the start that you work sort of across a few different media, right? You work in photography and you also work in film. And I guess I'd like to know, how do you find sort of the ethics of those practices? Do they differ? Do you find different challenges when you're working with different technologies, or are the issues sort of the same and the challenges the same?
I think the issues around representation are very similar, but the ethics of just relationships of the process of making are just more disparate and diverse when you're making a film, just because so many more people are involved. So I can set out my intentions and have my ethical, you know, practices of how I want to work with participants, but now I'm also dependent on my crew and everybody else involved to also work, you know, in ways that our values align. And, you know, I'm very lucky that, you know, my moving image work does not require like a massive Hollywood soundstage or anything. So I am working with a very small group of people, and I've taken time and, you know, intentionally done research and talked to people and found people that I really trust and that I feel, you know, work in similar ways. But it's just there's so many more steps involved in film along the way that often things may happen that you're like, ooh, you know, I wish that hadn't happened that way, or I would have done it differently. You just have less control. You have less control over the process than with a photograph where it's sort of just, it's you. Yeah.
I thought about exploring film a few years ago, but I realized that I'm too much of an only child to work with other people in that way. So I kind of quickly ruled that out and decided actually photography is kind of where I'm most comfortable.
I'm so compelled by them both. And because I'm thinking about the visuality of Black and queer folks, because I'm thinking about the audience, what I'm asking the audience to look at, what I'm hoping the audience will see, they offer such dramatically different relationships to the gaze. And so, you know, when I'm thinking through ideas, you know, with video, you can't look too long. You know, video, the type of work that I make, each scene, it's 3, 4, 5 seconds, and then it's gone. You can only look so much. Whereas with a photograph, you know, the self-portrait series is intentionally photographic, because on the one hand, when I'm out walking down the street, I don't want you staring at me trying to figure out if I'm a man or a woman, you know, or laying your assumptions on me. But in the gallery, I've intentionally decided you can look as long as you want. You know, the photograph offers an extended gaze that video doesn't. And I'm really interested in building both of those types of relationships with an audience who may not have had an opportunity to think about or understand, you know, the experiences that somebody like me has as we've just moved through the world.
I think that's such an interesting difference that you've pointed out between film and photography. Yeah, I don't know. I think that that's really, really interesting and really useful. And I guess you talk a lot about the audience, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the relationship that you have to the audience. And do you think that, you know, as artists or photographers or image producers, what responsibilities do we have to the audience? And maybe what responsibilities does the audience have to us?
That's a great question. I think maybe because my first career was communications, for me, my artwork, I think about it as a conversation. I think about it as a two-way dynamic. When I'm making work, you know, I'm not making the work just for me. You know, I'm putting in a gallery. I'm asking people to look at it. So to me, right there, there's a responsibility. If I'm asking you to look at it, then I have to think about my responsibilities to you in terms of how is what I'm asking you to look at accessible to you as an audience. So one small example is length. You know, I make video. I love looking at video in the gallery myself, but I find it difficult to watch a 55-minute, you know, video in the gallery space, you know. So most of my work is on the shorter length just because to me it's a more accessible conversation if it's something that you can actually sit and take in its entirety and length, and looking at how to communicate those things in terms of form, length is part of that. But I think audiences too have responsibilities, and I think it's something that often galleries shy away from. I think it's okay to ask the audience to do some work. I think it's okay to not have to spell everything out, you know. And very often if I'm looking at an artwork that's made by somebody who has a really different life experience to me, maybe I don't understand everything I'm looking at, but, you know, I can look stuff up, you know, I can do some work to try to bridge those gaps that might exist in a conversation. And I know very much galleries have diverse audiences and they're thinking about all their different stakeholders, but also I think it's okay to sort of prioritize an audience and to say, you know, this is a work that I'm making that is going to speak in one way to one audience and maybe speak in other ways to other audiences. And I think that's okay as well.
You had a first career before you became an artist, and this is really your second career. And so all these things about audience and representation, I guess they're all things that you've sort of been working through during the course of that second career. And I guess I'd like to know, what do you wish that you'd known when you first made that pivot? And what were the resources that you found really useful to having these types of conversations or thinking about these things in your work as you were exploring that?
Before I became an artist, I mean, I've been a lifelong art lover, you know? And in fact, my mom loved art, and, you know, I have very early memories of going to galleries with her as a child. So I would say as a viewer of art, that's the beginning of my thinking through of these issues. You know, even before I made the formal decision that I myself was going to become an artist, questions of audience, questions of representation are things that I was sort of taking in. And we all do, right? Like, we all are exposed to images. I mean, you know, we all have that classic first, you know, remember National Geographic and, you know, all of these sort of childhood formative experiences in building a relationship to images, but also building a relationship to artwork and contemporary art. So that, I think, is a lifelong ongoing learning. But I would say what I wish I had known is really the difference between conceptualizing a project as an image, as an object, and conceptualizing an exhibition, you know, the thinking through what it means to show work in an architectural space, you know, in relationship to where the doors are, where the windows are, you know, how to build that most productive relationship in the gallery. And again, that's something that I think comes from looking at other people's exhibitions, you know. I think often, particularly with some of my students, there's this kind of idea that they don't want to look at other people's work, that they want to build their own voice and build their own artistic vision separate from influence. But as I just said, you've already been looking at images your whole life. You know, you're already informed by every image you've ever seen. But to really understand how to build an exhibition, the only way to do that as a visual artist is to attend exhibitions, look at exhibitions, and pay attention to not just the photograph, but the size, you know, the distance, the way they're spaced out, you know. Very often, students or younger artists in my circles, they want big photographs. They want to make their photographs big. And I'm like, well, why? Why should this project be big? What is the relationship that you're asking the audience to have to a big image? Sometimes images should be small. People should lean in and think about it. So building that just embodied relationship in the gallery yourself as an artist, I think is really, really important. And I don't think we should be afraid to look at other people's work. You know, in the academy, it's expected that if you write a paper, that you will clearly show this person thought this, this person theorized this, and I built my knowledge in relationship to all these other knowledges that have been shared. But yet, as an artist, you're expected to just have an idea on your own. And I'm like, no, I can always talk to you about the artist. You know, it's like a citational practice to be able to say, Candice Brights did this, Phil Collins did this, and now I've done this with singing and video. You know what I mean? That these are influences and that my work is in conversation and is in relationship with other artists' work. And that's a good thing, you know, that's a benefit of looking at other people's work.
Absolutely. It's so funny. I think that this might be the third podcast interview in this season in which somebody has talked about this, about how maybe earlier career photographers, but some other photographers as well are reluctant to look at what other people have done, especially if it's on a specific community or specific topic, you know. But I think that's such an interesting thing because, of course, like you said, we already are influenced by all these things, and looking at those things will only make us more informed, not any more influenced, really, only more informed about, you know, what tropes have been used and how do I break those, you know? So I think that that's really interesting. That's been such a theme of this season because it's something that I personally am also really interested in and passionate about. I love what you said as well about materiality. You know, there's a reason why photographs might need to be big or need to be small or need to be in a book or need to be on a wall, you know? I'm really interested in thinking about the materiality of how work is presented. And I think that's, you know, related to or drawing from sort of Sarah Pink's work on sensory ethnography. I think it's really interesting hearing you talk about that. And I'd like to know, why is it that you have pursued in particular the gallery space as a space for exhibition of your work?
That's a good question. I think I was, as I said before, I was always drawn to the arts. And in my career as a health educator, my introduction to visual art or to the work that I'm making really came through community. So when I first came out, I got involved as a volunteer with our local LGBT film and video festival because it felt like a fun way to meet folks. And that ended up being like my film school. It was my first time seeing a short film. It was my first time seeing an experimental film. And it just really was such a powerful education in a DIY kind of just make it happen, you know, that films could be so many more things than I understood them to be. So I made my first short film in 2003 and I made a video in 2006. And so because I came through film festival world, so exhibiting through festivals, that was my first public sharing of work was through festivals. But also through that time, so many people who were making films were visual artists. And so I just sort of became part of a community and was involved heavily as a volunteer, sitting on boards, supporting smaller organizations in Toronto that way. And then after my mom passed away, I don't know, I think an MFA felt concrete and accessible to me as somebody who was then 40 years old. I think I've always liked school. I like research, I like theory. So pursuing that format felt familiar and comfortable. And to be honest, I mean, as I said, I love photography. I'm grateful for my career, but I have a lot of insecurities around my technical abilities around photography. So, you know, I can make fine art images. I don't know that I'm skilled enough or knowledgeable enough to work commercially or editorially at this point, you know. And I've certainly, you know, the best way to deal with insecurities is just avoidance, right? So been dealing with that over the last little while. And I just turned 49 last week and I had already sort of set a personal goal for myself that between 49 and 50, that was the vulnerability that I needed to lean in for myself. I'm working on one more moving image work for upcoming exhibition. And then I've committed to just, I was like, the only way out is through. The only way to get over these insecurities is to put in the time and to practice and to stop avoiding it. So I'm really looking forward to kind of tapping that personal demon and strengthening my photography skills. It doesn't mean I'm interested in working editorially or commercially, but just to build my own confidence around the images that I am making.
Yeah, that resonates a lot. I'm very much in the self-taught category of photography. And I think that sort of imposter syndrome is definitely hard to shake. And I think some people in previous seasons of the podcast have talked about that as well. And it's interesting to talk with people who have gone through a formal photography program and people who haven't, and the different challenges and the different benefits that both sides have. So it is really interesting that there definitely isn't one right way forward. But I think through, like you said, is probably a very good solution for sure. And can you tell me, what does photography ethics mean to you?
I think photography ethics is, it foregrounds for me that we are in relation to each other. It foregrounds to me that I see myself less as an individual with rights and more as part of a community to whom I have responsibilities. And so it is a way of working, and not just in the making of the photograph, everything. It is a way of addressing people in emails, you know, it's a way of working with galleries. It's everything that I do. It's the way that I teach, how I treat my students, how I build my lesson plans. It's foregrounding the responsibilities that I have as part of a community and thinking about, as I said, power is embedded in all of those positions I hold: artist, teacher, photo laureate. I hold a certain amount of power. So it means, how do I leverage that power for, I mean, it's hard because ethics always equates morals. And for me, it's not so much about good and bad, but it's about harm reduction almost. You know, one of the things humans are really good at is we hurt each other, sometimes intentionally, most times unintentionally. And so how do I work? How do I make decisions? How do I set up processes that hopefully minimize harm as I pursue the things that I, you know, that I'm drawn to pursue.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Photo Ethics Podcast. The aim of this podcast is to share new insights about photography ethics with others. So if you heard something you liked, please share this podcast with someone who would appreciate it. The links to all things mentioned in this episode are available in the show notes at www.photoethics.org. Join me next week when we hear from Tara Todras-Whitehill on becoming a storyteller. In each episode of the podcast, we ask our guests, what does photography ethics mean to you? This is a question that everyone in the photography industry should be able to answer. That's why the Photography Ethics Center is asking you, our listeners, to commit to writing and publishing your own statement of ethics. Visit www.photoethics.org/ethics to learn more and to make the pledge committing to ethical transparency, accountability, and awareness. That's www.photoethics.org/ethics. This podcast was edited and digitally produced by Ellie Gascoigne.